something good and loving for ourselves.
Okay, thank you so much.
Linda, see you tomorrow. Have
okay,
a nice day,
care.
Everyone.
212-209-2950 is the number to call. We have a final moment here for you to join Clarence and Bettina and others who are calling now. 212-209-2950. And they are asking for Gary Nell's Superfood Breakfast and the film, The Happiness in an Unhappy World film. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. And what you're really doing is you're supporting this listener-sponsored radio station. And you're doing this and you're getting something very good for you, something good for yourself by calling 212-209-2950. Ask for Gary Nell's Superfood Breakfast and you will also get the film, Happiness in an Unhappy World. And we are in our fun drive, but we have not been having constant fun drive programs. We are trying to bring you information and our regular programs as much as we can throughout the day, but yet WBAI needs to pay its bills. And this is one way of us doing that, by having you, by you going, taking the initiative, going to your phone, calling 212-209-2950. Thank you so much, those of you who are calling. Please continue to call.
Happy talk, keep talking, happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to do. You've got to have a dream. If you don't have a dream, how you gonna have a
good morning.
Dream?
You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. This Gary Nell special came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 7 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
The 2021 local station board delegate elections are underway. A donation of $25 by June 30th gives you the right to vote and to run to serve on the board. Cast your candidacy before July 14th. Visit elections.pacifica.org to complete the nominations paperwork online and to contact your local election supervisor. Leave a voicemail on 510-993-0320 if you do not have access to a computer.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Last week was intended to be a continuation of an interview with writer and critic Terrence Taylor, focusing on contemporary speculative fiction TV and movies and how they relate to Juneteenth. But there was a last-minute glitch in my sending it to the station. My bad. But the show is still relevant, and that is what we're going to hear this morning. Starting with a review of Black Lightning from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. So I've been spending the past few months catching up on Black Lightning, the Greg Berlanti-produced DC Universe series that aired for 4 seasons on the CW, and the first 3 seasons of which are available on Netflix, with probably the 4th to follow soon. I'm midpoint through the 3rd season, but I can pretty definitively say at this juncture that not only is this the best of the Berlantiverse series, it's one of the best superhero series overall. The Berlanti template still shows. There's the obligatory lesbian relationship, which is fine, no objections to the representation. I'd just like for once for there to be a male same-sex relationship, just to freshen things up a bit. And superhero Jefferson Pierce slash Black Lightning, played by Cress Williams, is given a secret, high-tech support base, which kind of undercuts the specialness of the superhero thing. To the show's credit, though, instead of an entire, highly funded support team, there's only a rogue government agent, Gambi, played by James Remar, backing Pierce up from a jerry-rigged, but still improbably capable basement lab. There is a lot, though, that raises Black Lightning above the pack. The cast is uniformly excellent, especially Cress Williams. Christine Adams as Pierce's estranged wife and dedicated biologist, Lynn. William Catlett as the immortal, tortured crime lord, Lala. And Bill Duke as the eerie, sociopathic agent, Odell. Since the setup is pretty grounded, there are no out-and-out monsters in the show's urban, largely black setting of Freeland. The digital special effects don't try to exceed the constraints of a TV budget. And the show overall looks great, with good production design and cinematography, although the latter too often leans too far to blue casts for my taste. But what really sets the show apart is that, unlike the other Berlantiverse shows that are satisfied with a blend of standard relationship drama and superheroics, the creators of Black Lightning have a greater agenda. If HBO's Watchmen used the horror of the Tulsa Massacre to fuel its narrative, series creator Salim Akil has taken advantage of the show's 4 seasons to display a broad canvas of the darker side of the black experience. And a lot gets covered. The storylines manage to reference the likes of the Tuskegee Experiment, Rodney King, Stop and Frisk, black-on-black racism, even the Underground Railroad and the migrant internment camps are invoked. There's anger to this show, not unjustified when you see the centuries of injustices and those still ongoing laid out before you it's easy to understand where that rage comes from. The show does dance around the issue of poverty and how that ties into systemic racism. And like any genre show that tackles real-world issues, there's a point where reality has to end and the need for entertaining and satisfying storytelling begins. To creator Salim Akil's credit, Black Lightning doesn't deploy any magical quick fixes to our nation's ills, but this is still a superhero show with a mandate to entertain, so the fictional Freeland gets its charismatic fighter for justice and his superpowered family, while we out here in the everyday world gotta muddle through as best we can. But that's just the flaw of fictional storytelling overall. It can never be as messy or unresolved as real life. That Black Lightning is bold enough to confront a number of vexing issues is worthy of note. That it's a great show above and beyond that makes it cause for celebration. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And hello again, everybody. This is a continuation of last week's conversation with Terrence Taylor, which is still, of course, in the WBAI archive. And he and I spoke about recent TV shows and things, particularly some of the Disney Plus Marvel type things. And we were going to, actually we did, talk somewhat about The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And it was only that I realized that we weren't going to have enough time to fit that all in, and that today, Saturday, the 19th, is Juneteenth.
Of course.
So so we're going to frame the show to talk about things that tie into that. And actually, Falcon and the Winter Soldier is a very, very good place to start because it seems to have taken Marvel's sights and moved them beyond just Black Panther to other cultures, American cultures for that matter, that have been ignored. And I thought that that particular story did a fabulous job in more ways than one.
Yes. I mean, it covered a lot of ground. The first episode I was a little wary of because it was mostly about Sam and Bucky not being happy. Sam can't get a bank loan to save the family boat. Bucky is like, you know, being best friends with someone whose son he killed and can't admit it to. And I was like, but then, you know, the second episode, the main story, the terrorist quote unquote, because that becomes questionable by the end, storyline started. And that became fascinating. And then the whole U.S. agent, pre-U.S. agent, the whole new Captain America thing. So as it built, it actually turned into a really fascinatingly nuanced storyline for me. And when they introduced Elijah, is that the name of the former Black
Isaiah.
Captain America?
Isaiah.
It's a turn I hadn't actually seen them do in the comic, though I may be wrong, but that whole dialogue was fascinating in terms of the three generations in dialogue and the different opinions. The whole conflict over being Black and being patriotic was fascinating. My father was in the Air Force for 20 years. He joined at a point where, you know, the military was fairly racist. He got a lot of flack for a lot of different reasons. And the main reason my life changed was that he was working as an assistant to a general who thought he was really super sharp and on the ball and asked him why he wasn't in officer's candidate school. And my dad said, because I haven't gone to college and they won't admit me. And the general said, well, I'll see what we can do about that. And made a phone call and got him in. And my dad became an officer. He became a navigator in the Air Force. We traveled the world. I think he was a major by the time he got out. But that was transformative. And it was for a lot of people. But that conflict over loving a country that historically has treated your family and ancestors so poorly is the thing that no one understands. I find it fascinating because I was reading something recently which was making me think about the fact that the people who have the best things to say about America are the immigrants, the people who came to this country because of what was publicized as the American dream, who succeeded to varying degrees, but whose image of what America is much broader and much more loving, if anything, than the people who take it for granted, who dig in, who want it all just to be white and a particular group and way of thinking and Christian and evangelical. And their image of what this country is amazingly limited and excludes everything that essentially made America what it is. The flow of information in the form of people is what really made this country great. You know, we got new ideas. Steve Jobs, you know, I mean, his family were immigrants. I mean, so it just goes down the line. So that there were so many things like that. The whole conversations between him and the young woman who's leading the group, who's taken the super soldier serum and is using it for a political cause that's getting them beloved by the masses but hated by governments. Before we go on, we should warn anyone listening once again that there will be many spoilers in this conversation.
Good. Okay.
Before we so the conversations and the final confrontation between Sam and the politicians that they're saving over, should we be arresting and shooting these people, or should we be dealing with the issues that created this movement in the first place, which all of you can fix if you talk? And that was amazing.
It was also a very interesting movement, I thought, on the grounds that it wasn't it wasn't that crazy. It wasn't like a QAnon kind of
thing.
It was a movement that, if you, given the history that's happens in the big phase three finale endgame and all that, it's not an unreasonable political position for people to say that they were doing fine without governments before everybody came back, which may or may not be true. It's arguable.
But well, you know,
it wasn't crazy.
No. And it was nuanced, thought out. The conversations covered a lot of ground and they were great. So there was that. That was fascinating. I mean, basically, it's a Socratic dialogue in the form of a science fiction series of people shouting dialectic across, you know, rooms as they're shooting at each other, but it worked. And the other storylines for both Sam and Bucky, Sam dealing with the fact that he has the shield and doesn't know what to do with it, gives it back, and then it comes back to him in essence, and he finally takes on the mantle that Steve basically handed him when he handed him the shield. And Bucky's the only one in the whole thing who says, look, he gave it to you. He wanted you to be that. And I kept wanting Sam to just say that to everyone who confronted him on that. So that opens the door in the next season to a whole range of things that were done in the comics enormously well. One of the things I love was when they were doing the storyline in the Marvel comics, which I won't get into in depth. I know, you know, people don't watch, read the comics. Yeah. But the point that I want to make is that the period in which they made Sam Captain America and Steve took a back seat before he came back again and got young again, was the same year that, you know, the Sad Puppies were doing the whole thing, taking over the Hugos, basically this group of embittered, angry white males who felt they were being displaced, which they were not. They were not being replaced. They were being augmented. We added characters. Ms. Marvel didn't eliminate Captain Marvel, who undoubtedly annoyed a lot of people because it was a woman and not the guy they grew up with. But it just goes on through all that. But in the comic, they had Sam, people shouting things to Sam that they were saying to Marvel, essentially. And Marvel took everything that was being thrown at them and laid it out in the pages of these comics in a way that said, look at this in black and white. Is this really who you want to be? And also, kind of was the best retort to it, it more so than just saying, well, you know, we're trying to do such and such. It was like, just lay it out there and let people make up their own minds. So I look forward to seeing where that goes. Bucky dealing with his guilt and his therapy, and trying to make restitution. It's like AA, Assassins Anonymous. You know, the first step is to ask forgiveness. But that is interesting. I don't know where that's going to go in that last conversation, but you know, it's about him taking culpability for his actions in the past. So yeah. I thought that was great. It brought up for me a lot of other issues around the last couple of years of material that's been going on around Black history, particularly, or Black stories in general. And I think a lot of it got highlighted during the Black Lives Matters movement over the summers that we had after the deaths that we had, because there were multiple. And I think it's very well intentioned. I think it's deserved. I think we need to get those stories made. But as an individual, I started to hit a point where it got too difficult to watch that much Black pain being depicted so graphically. I love Watchmen. I thought Regina was amazing. I thought the whole thing was pretty amazing. It dealt with issues of race enormously, from this hidden organization of white supremacists within the police to the modern day incarnation trying to become superpowered and take over the world. All of those things were fascinating, the lynchings, all of that. But and the graphic depiction of the bombing and the lynching, I call it, of Tulsa. But all that's enormously hard to watch. I haven't yet been able to watch Lovecraft Country because it's focused around Lovecraftian horrors and racism around a Black family. And I do want to see it at some point. But but it's been a difficult year to see these things, I guess, really. This is not the best time to watch a lot of those things. And I could go down the list. There are other programs doing the same thing right now. The Underground Railroad has just debuted. And it's done by a really brilliant director from a really brilliant book. I mean, Colson Whitehead is an amazing writer. I haven't read The Underground Railroad. I read The Nickel Boys and was just devastated by the end and sobbing and all through. I mean, he tells these stories amazingly well in a way that involves you. And I have no doubt that Underground Railroad is going to be a long, difficult journey, no pun intended. But at the same time, I there's a part of me that really wants to see the art involved and to see how the story's told. But I've realized there's so much out there. There are also love stories being made, thank God, but I'm not a big love story guy, so that's not helping me. but the particular stories, I think, are great value to the general population who may not quite get why there's so much anger and unhappiness. But, you know, I started to realize that there's a certain level of not denial, but whether we like to admit it or not, Black people in this country have to walk around with a particular layer of armor that keeps us from just bursting into rage. I think Baldwin, or I can't remember who the quote was from or even the direct quote, but basically that rage is the only rational reaction to the situation that we find ourselves. And essentially what we do each day is function in the world, suppressing that rage. One of the issues, of course, I discovered in therapy is suppressed rage turns to depression. It explains a lot of the mental state of a lot of Black people in this country if they can't do that. It explains, you know, people in middle management just going, you know, not having to smile every day and code switch and not be who they are. At work, I'm lucky in that I'm in television. I'm at a public television station where pretty much everybody can be whoever they are. One of our employees came out recently as non-binary. We now refer to them as they or them. And everyone's fine with that. You know, just got announced at a work meeting and we were like, okay, cool. But that's a subset of the world. And so I think it's valuable. I think these things, stories need to be told. I think they need to be there, but I'm realizing that Black people aren't necessarily the audience for it, that we kind of know all this, and seeing it depicted so realistically as it can be now is so painful. There's just so much Black death on screen right now. And I understand the reasons for it, and it's good that those stories are being told, but I'm realizing it's for the people who don't get it. And that right now, the way the world's been for the last year and a half, some of us need to just pull back a little bit until we're stronger and able to deal with it more. But they did an amazing job. And all of this is good. I mean, these are stories that just have been ignored, or even just characters and actors that have been
ignored. Yeah, for me, you mentioned in passing two scenes that really hit home the whole thing for me. The first one is just in passing when it's clear that Sam, who is at this point world famous as an Avenger, can't get a bank loan. And it's done in this beautifully understated manner where, you know, if he was white, he and his sister would have had it in moments.
And to a degree, there's a level of unrealism with that. I think the celebrity status would outweigh that. Oprah would get a loan. Trying to do. I mean, because the bank manager is also trying to get a selfie with him at the same time he's denying his loan. So essentially, they did a really good job. I think that unlike
that was one thing. The other thing was not to understate that first conversation or the second conversation that Sam has with Isaiah. Now, I thought Isaiah was an incredible character. I think if he wasn't in there, even though he has very small screen time, I think the whole story really revolves around him, about the idea that here's somebody else who was given that same super soldier serum after Captain America went away. And his result is that things didn't work out scientifically initially the way they were going to, and they put this guy away for 30 years.
Yeah.
And what do you recall the exact line? There's one line that Isaiah says to Sam about wearing colors.
No, I don't remember.
Okay. Well, it more or less comes down to, when Sam talks about why he turned the shield back, he says, after pointing out exactly what the government had done to him, he says, "Are you sure that you want to wear those colors?"
Well, yeah.
And that's the question, isn't it? You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name's Jim Freund. We now return to our conversation with writer Terrence Taylor.
Well, you know, it's a question that gets asked a lot. Black people become cops and black people join the military. For a long time, military, outside of sports or entertainment, was the only real out a lot of black people had out of poverty, because you could get an education. My dad joined because we could get the GI Bill. When he got out after his 20 years, he got his undergrad at Howard, got his MBA at Columbia, went into business and did quite well for the time he could. He went to Texas during the oil boom, and then it went bust, and that affected a lot of different things. But yeah, I mean, it was an option, but there was always that conflict of, the term Uncle Tom gets thrown around a lot in the black community, usually by people bitter that someone has achieved something they haven't and accuses them of being complicit. That goes back to slavery days, where you had the conflict between the field Negroes and the house Negroes. The house Negroes perceived as being, more privileged because they live more comfortably. Certainly their job was not as tough. And usually the ones most susceptible to sexual predation and giving birth to multiracial children who maybe had it easier because the master would at least on that level acknowledge. So it all roots back to stuff. I mean, I look at so many conflicts in the black community, and so much of it, from whipping our children and psychologically breaking them as discipline, which is still done. I mean, was certainly done to me, but that comes totally out of the slavery period of, that's how we were disciplined. You whipped us and you broke us psychologically. And we learned that. We learned a lot of things. And that's, to me, that is the root of reparation. Reparations isn't about giving 50 grand to everybody black in the country and letting them do whatever they want with it. It's about establishing educational systems that educate people who would not have access otherwise. It's about therapy. It's about correcting the social issues that are still a legacy of that period that have kept a large portion of the population. I mean, God knows, yes, there's a lot of black people who managed to get to college, who managed, that's going to lessen as the cost goes up, because I'm already seeing that affecting people I know. But it's, you know, that's what we need to fix something beyond economy. We need to fix a people who are put in a situation that very few groups in this country understand. There are other groups that have other issues. I don't diminish any of those. The Irish were treated like dogs when they arrived, but they got past that. We've gotten past a lot. I mean, I used to say that considering that the Emancipation Proclamation was 1867, I think. I mean, in the 60s, we'd only been free for 100 years. And the fact that we've even come as far as we have in that short time, roughly short time period of less than 10 generations, I think is an amazing credit to the durability and survival of the black people in this country and what we're able to accomplish despite everything. That takes us to Juneteenth, this day that we're celebrating. And I don't know that celebrating is the right word. I think observing is closer to it. I'd heard the term for years. I knew that Ellison had written, Ralph Ellison, after his house burned down with his second novel, that the only other thing he'd really gotten out was I think it was either a play or a novel first got made into a play, but Juneteenth was his last work. I'd heard the term. I didn't know really what it was. Oh, hang on a second. Sorry. Actually, I touched a touch tablet and turned on my radio. So I didn't know the historical information behind it. I just heard of it as a Black Southern celebration. When it came up again during the Black Lives Matter summer, where everybody was really getting involved in the issues, I found out the real history. And it's the history
and
of it.
There are still people who don't want to acknowledge it. I was shocked and appalled, as were a great many people, when on Memorial Day, some distinguished veteran, a white man, was doing a graduation speech or Memorial Day speech to, I think, military graduates at that point. And he started, at one point in his speech, he discussed the origins of Memorial Day, which, of course, actually have to do with...
I think I read about this, yeah.
Memorial Day began... before it was just burying dead of the Civil War, there were some black people down in, I think, Carolina, who had buried some soldiers down there, Northern soldiers primarily. And that was the first Memorial Day. And as this guy started talking about that, this distinguished old, or not old, but distinguished experience veteran, they cut off his mic.
Yeah.
In today's day
amazing
age, from a white man to a predominantly white audience, there were people who just, and this is in Ohio.
Well,
right, this is not the
I've spent my time in Ohio. Well, I wouldn't discount that with Ohio. Ohio and Pennsylvania are two very specific areas of the North. Well, you know, okay, well, let's get back to the origins of Juneteenth. I found out that it was 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation that the Northern soldiers got deep enough into the South to get to Texas to tell the slaves there that they'd been freed 2 years earlier and enforce that, because they now had troops there that could enforce that, and they enforced the freedom. And there was a celebration of, oh my God, we're finally free. You know, this finally, this long nightmare has ended. And it became an annual thing in the South observing that. But it's not, to me, it's like Martin Luther King Day. It's not necessarily a day of celebration. I don't think Juneteenth's anything to celebrate. That's the most, one of the most appalling stories.
Well, if you take the word celebrate
let me finish the sentence.
Commemorate, I think, is the
word. Well, if you would let me get the sentence finished. I'm going to that. Let me finish my thought, which is, we call things celebrations, which are not necessarily things to be celebrated despite whatever